Hi, my name is Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I didn't know there was a dance going on here and that there would be quite so many people here. I probably would have thought of something else that I had to do, but my sponsor probably would have kicked my ass, so I'm here. Welcome to all the newcomers. There's a lot of newcomers. That's good. I'm very, very nervous, so please bear with me. God will kick in really soon, I hope. If not, then you have to deal with me solely, so that might be really terrible. I'll tell you a little bit what it was like. The first time I ever drank, I was about 14 years old, and I liked the way that it made me feel. It made me feel different. I didn't really like the way that I felt when I wasn't under the influence of something. But my stepfather was a raging alcoholic, and he would do things like pass out on the kitchen floor with the door open of the refrigerator. And I thought, you know what? I never want to be like that. So I turned to drugs. I know this is an AA meeting, but drugs are part of my story. And so for the next couple years, I really got into them, and all during high school, I didn't attend as frequently as they would have liked. I used a lot, and I did do some drinking, but I always got sick because I drank a lot when I drank, so that wasn't a clue. I didn't get a clue yet. But when I was about 22 and I got married to the first husband, I started drinking a lot because I couldn't smoke pot anymore because I couldn't control how I acted. So I started drinking. And big surprise, I couldn't control how I acted then either. I wasn't faithful to him. I was really bored. He was a homebody. I was only 22 years old. I didn't want to be a homebody. I wanted to go out and play and have fun. And he just wanted to stay home. And so we parted company. And I found the bar scene. Oh, gosh. I was in my element. It was really fun. I had a great time. I did create a lot of wreckage during that time. I was never the kind of drinker that could drink 4 or 5 shots of anything. It was like 9 or 10 or 11 or 12. I remember one time going to LA with a friend of mine, and we drank 24 Bacardi and Cokes. And I was so proud of myself. I mean, what an accomplishment. During the time that I left my first husband, I got into going to bars a lot. Every night, I'd have a really, really hard time getting up in the morning. So one year, I think I worked at 12 different jobs, and I'd have these fabulous excuses as to why I couldn't go into work. I mean, I'd gotten so many car wrecks, you wouldn't believe it. My ankle was perpetually bruised. But I would always quit my jobs before I get fired. You could tell that look. I don't know about you guys, but when you walk in for the umpteenth time and you're either haven't been there for a few days or you're late again, they gave you that look of like, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? You know, and I didn't have a clue that what I was doing was abnormal or bad for me or anything. I didn't have a clue that I was an alcoholic because the people that I drank with drank like I drank. And, or almost, you know, they came real close. I prided myself on being able to drink people under the table a lot of times. I went through a lot of men. You know, my motto then was, you know, use them, abuse them, and lose them. And I did it well, and I did it frequently. I'm not proud of it, but, you know, that's just what I did. And So I met another husband, and well, he wasn't my husband then, but he became my husband. And we did a lot of abusive drinking, verbal abusive, and in that period of time, my drinking progressed to the point where I became a blackout drinker. And of course I didn't know I was a blackout drinker because I was blacked out and I had no idea what I was doing. But I would wake up in the morning with that horrible feeling in my stomach of like, oh my God, what have I done? You know, sometimes windows would be broken. One time my mom spent the night to watch my son and she just had this look of total disgust on her face, you know, rehashing the things that I did, and I tried to pretend like, oh, well, yeah, I did them on purpose, you know, I knew I did those things, and I had not a clue what she was talking about, and that was really scary for me. I thought at that time that I would, you know, that possibly I have a drinking problem, so I started doing coke a lot more so I could balance it out and keep that level of intellect going. That didn't work either. I left that husband and took my son. And in the meantime, I have this little baby, a year and a half year old baby, who depends on me for everything. And I'm just, you know, drinking on a daily basis. I remember waking up in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning at times, and have that horrible taste in your mouth, that terrible headache, and know that you kind of passed out, but you're waking up now and you're ready to go again. And I would drink get an old rum and coke that was watered down and drink it down and start drinking again. You know, that's insane. That's totally insane when you have to go to work the next day. Because of my drinking, I went to jail. And not directly because of my drinking. Because I was drinking, I had no perception of what I was doing, and I sold some drugs to an undercover narcotics agent. And they frowned on that, and they sent me to jail for 72 days. I went to a work furlough program, and that was really humiliating for me. And that was the first time that I was introduced to the program, and that was the first time that I was ever sober, and it was the longest I had ever been sober, which was for 72 days. It wasn't by anything that I did, trust me. It was only because I couldn't. The moment I got out of there, I drank. And a friend of mine who I had met in jail was like, well, so did you drink when you got out? I said, well, yeah, I had a beer. You know, like, that's okay. Can't you have just one beer when you're in AA? Well, no, you can't. You have to start all over again. I'm like, oh, shit. Okay. So I tried, you know, I tried the program for a little bit. But then, you know, it got in the way of my drinking. So I did what, you know, a good alcoholic would do in normal situations. I became a bartender. And my drinking progressed a lot. And my drug usage progressed a lot because I worked until 2 o'clock in the morning, so I had to stay awake. And then in order to come down, I had to drink, and sometimes drinking didn't do it, so I had to take some Valium. And, you know, I'd have to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning to send my son off to school if I got up at 7 o'clock in the morning, so I'd have to do a little crank. And, you know, it was like, oh, my God. One time I had to leave work because I was freaking out. I couldn't. I think I was having a stroke or something. I have no idea. My fingers were turning blue. I was having heart palpitations. And, I mean, I probably was killing myself. I probably could have died, but I didn't, you know. And I didn't drink or do any drugs for 2 days. I was so proud of myself. And, you know, just went right back into it again. And I got out of bartending because I needed to be with my son at night, and so I got a different job. And I remember a girlfriend of mine came over one night, and we were partying extensively. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I don't know where this came from, but I turned to her and I said, you know, do you feel like your life's unmanageable? And she said, yeah, I do. I go, well, I want to go to AA. You know, like, oh, shh, don't tell anyone. It's a big secret cult. And so that was a Thursday night. I had to go to work on Friday. And then that Saturday, we went to a women's meeting at Alana West. Well, that was about 4.5 years ago. I didn't stay. I came here, and the fourth and the ninth step scared me to death. There was no way I was going to tell anybody everything about me, and there was no way I was going to apologize for anything that I did, because it wasn't my fault. You know, most of the time you made me do it. It was your fault, and I only reacted to the situation, and I was in the right. So I didn't stay. I wasn't ready. And so both of us, you know, went back out again. And then, you know, I only stayed out about 5 or 6 months. And I got, in that time, I got twice as bad as I was the first time or the second time. And on March 13th, it was a Friday the 13th, 3 years ago, I was crying. I was on my knees. I was begging God to help me. I can't do this anymore. My life is in shambles. I drank on a daily basis. I drank to black out. And, you know, I asked him for help, and I called my job and told him that I fell down the stairs and sprained my ankle and I wouldn't be into work for a couple of days. And, you know, I needed to do that for me to get here to have some time, because I knew that I was a waitress and bartending a bit, and I knew that if I couldn't get a few meetings under my belt and had to go back in that environment, I would drink again. And since that time, you know, my life has changed tremendously. God is a really big part of my life today. You know, when I was out there, I believed in a supreme being, but, you know, when I went to church, I pretty much fell asleep. I had no idea what God was about. And, you know, my parents just did it for the social contacts, so there was no Bible thumping in my home. And, you know, it took me a while. I've been sober for 3 years, and it took me a while to let go and let God take care of me. And, you know, it's the most incredible thing that no matter what happens to me in my life, no matter what I feel, no matter what I think, I can turn it over to God and He'll take care of it. You know, when I'm in fear, which is a lot, when I'm emotional, and it seems like, my God, the more sober I get, the more emotional I become. I mean, I'm just an emotional basket case sometimes. These feelings, how do normal people do this? It's just, it's really hard for me sometimes. I'll start crying for no reason. Like today I was crying all day. You know, maybe it was because I was a bit nervous about this, and was maybe if I cried my eyes would swell up shut and I wouldn't be able to come and speak here. I don't know. There's always an ulterior motive in my head. But, you know, I never realized that I was so afraid of everything when I was out there. I mean, the reason I drank was because I was afraid to live, because I was afraid to feel. I was afraid when I got sober that I wouldn't be able to talk, and that the only reason that I was such a little chatty Cathy was because I did so much crank. Well, it's not true. I'm quite capable of carrying on a conversation. But, you know, being sober is, it is the best way. It is the best life. God's helped me, but you know what? My friends have helped me. My sponsors helped me. My grand sponsor, my sisters, my sponsees, you people have helped me. And, you know, God talks through all of you so that I can hear what you have to say, and that so you can help me on a daily basis. And for you newcomers, just give it a shot. You know, go to a couple meetings, go to a couple more meetings, and don't drink between those meetings. And, You know, you can have a really good life. You know, I'm not always really happy with my life. In fact, sometimes I'm really pissed off about being sober. Because now I know that I have to do the right thing, and sometimes I'd like to go back to the old way and, you know, just tell everyone to fuck off, but I can't do that. And I don't want to do that anymore. I got in a big fight with my son before I came over here. He's 12. God bless him. And I have to go home and make an amends to him because I said some words that I shouldn't have said. And without this program, I'd be sitting here going, oh, it's all his fault. But it's not his fault. He's 12. He can't help it. I can. And, you know, with God in the program, you can do it too. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody. My name is John. I am an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here. I was thinking while the young lady was speaking that it was exactly 19 years ago and one night that I went to my first AA meeting. It was at St. Luke's on a Tuesday night. And I was 4 days without taking anything. And I didn't know it. The reason I was so interested with this, we had 22 newcomers that announced themselves. And I'm sure there were a few who didn't feel up to announcing themselves as a newcomer. But I need to tell you, based upon the last 19 years of my life, that from the second I walked into that first AA meeting to this second, I've never had it so good. I've never had it so good. And if you find, as all of us can find, but if you find just a fraction of what I found in here, you too can say the same thing, because my cup runneth over. This is really the only good life. I was talking with somebody before the meeting. He happened to be your speaker from last week. And he was trying to console me because he was so dynamic that he didn't want me to be embarrassed this evening. And I'm going to try not to humiliate him too much. But if he keeps actions going on and talking to me like that, maybe he'd better get himself a new sponsor. You hear an awful lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous about being an alcoholic, being born an alcoholic, or whatever. All I know is this is a very brief part of my story, is that my first major failure in life occurred when I was in kindergarten, when I flunked out of rhythm band. Now that's enough to disappoint and disillusion a lot of people, but I want to tell you that did not make me an alcoholic. It didn't do it. Now, the fact that I'm a depression baby, and I was raised in a depression baby, and according to my brother and my sisters and the rest of my family, we were awfully poor, but I didn't know it. Now, that sure as hell didn't make me an alcoholic. My father drank a lot. As a matter of fact, my father died from the disease called alcoholism. But it didn't make me an alcoholic. I had to do something to get the honor of becoming an alcoholic. I had to drink alcohol. But I was a late bloomer. By that meaning, I didn't pick up any alcohol because I was too good for the slobs who did. I didn't pick up any alcohol until I was 18 years old. I was in the Green Frog in El Paso, Texas. And I met Mr. Bourbon. And it's kind of interesting. I there's perhaps a lot of ways that somebody can tell their story, but I can only tell to you from my position today, because you see, I look back upon my life before I got here, and I see it out of entirely different eyes. And I used to say that I fell in love with bourbon whiskey that night. But this is what I truly happened to me, is that they gave me, I'm not too sure of all the mixes they gave me that night, because they knew I had never had a drink before in my entire life. And I got bourbon and 7. I think I got bourbon and Coke. I got bourbon and soda. I got bourbon and more shit than you can possibly imagine. And I was getting green behind all of that gunk they were putting on me. And before they added something to my next shot of bourbon whiskey, I downed it. And I said, oh man, that's good. And so that's why I thought I fell in love with bourbon whiskey. I liked it. I liked it straight. But I happen to be a person who tried to always aspired for class. And I think drinking bourbon whiskey out of the shot glass is just not very classy. And so I could summarize my drinking years by, I spent 10 years learning how to put ice in it. Then I spent 10 years learning how to put a splash of soda in it. And then I spent the last 10 years looking cool, man. Looking cool. You know, I do not know why it was that I didn't necessarily fit in life. When I say didn't fit, I fit fine. I could get along with anybody. I could do anything. But it just seemed to me as that I was just I didn't belong in society. And I knew that I knew that it was my fault. Now, I'm not talking the poor me's. I knew that if I just did it a little better, I'd get it right and things wouldn't happen, you know. I knew that my father had drinking, that if I was a decent son, that he probably wouldn't have drank as bad as he did, and he sure as hell wouldn't fight when he came home. You know, and in some respect, I felt that was my fault. I knew that all I had to do, you know, when you're young and you're invincible. You're going to live forever. And the world is always bright and shiny. And that's the way I thought it was for me. But I just didn't quite fit in it. You know, it seems as I can talk about a lot of disappointments that were significant to me and altered my life, but actually don't really make a hell of a lot of, doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference when it comes down to sobriety. I remember one of the great, I had held a state record in the half mile once. And I came into my senior year in high school. Now, you're a really cool kid, because you're the returning letterman, and you got the state record, and you're going to go to college, and you're going to become rich and famous, and everything's going to cool. And they gave me a heart murmur, and I couldn't run. And I couldn't get my girlfriends to come sit in the audience and watch me pole vault and broad jump and high jump. And I felt bad, you know. I don't know what the hell I started with that crap for. It doesn't make any difference, because it has nothing to do with the disease of alcoholism, is that I had to start drinking alcohol. I was a very ambitious person. I had 2 good years of drinking. I was a miserable drunk. I hear stories of people that have such wonderful times drinking, and they do such fabulous things. I had a miserable time drinking. I was a lousy drunk. I was never satisfied with what I did. I had 2 good years of drinking. I happened to be blessed or cursed, whatever, with an ability to fight very well. I fought in the ring and I fought in the streets. You may not know this, but I'm the 6th Army champion. I lost one fight, the 9th Service Command Championship. And I'm a Golden Gloves champion for the state of Texas. Until it got in my way, because I found bourbon whiskey. But when I found bourbon whiskey, I stopped fighting. I had a couple professional fights, but I stopped fighting because it interfered with my training, and I was training by drinking bourbon whiskey. And that's when I talk about having 2 good years of drinking. From 18 to 20 years, I had a hell of a lot of fun. At least I thought I had fun. I liked to go to places where I shouldn't go, see if there was somebody that would like to beat me up. And when they found they couldn't, then I could celebrate. Isn't that wonderful? Just impresses the living hell out of me today. Well, I thought I was somebody then. But when somebody attempted to do something in the streets of Los Angeles down on Spring Street, if I remember correctly, somebody got hurt really bad, and a couple people went to the hospital, and from that second to this, I've never hit anybody. That didn't mean I didn't want to, and it hasn't meant that I haven't met some people that desperately need it, but I have never done it, because my life altered from that point of view, and so did my drinking. That's when I became a lousy drunk. That's because that's when I couldn't drink enough. That's when I drank too much. That's when I drank in the wrong place. That's when I woke up in the wrong places. That's when I did the things I didn't want to do. That's when I married my high school sweetheart. And my first daughter, my oldest daughter was born, that coupled with the decision of what happened in the streets of Los Angeles, I decided to become a businessman and support. I wanted to fulfill my destiny, and that was to be a good citizen, to be a good husband, a good father, to do the right things in life. And so I launched into a business career, if you would, and I became very successful. And the more successful I became, the more I drank and the more cool. That's when I got into my martini stages. Because if you're a businessman, you have to drink martinis. And a lunch is not a lunch unless you've had 6. And then, of course, you go back to work, naturally. I bragged for years that one of the biggest deals that I wrote when I was in the construction industry and as an engineering salesman in Los Angeles, one of the biggest deals I wrote, which amounted to quite a few $1 million over a year, was after one afternoon. This is how cool I was. I was sitting there in this big contractor's office in Beverly Hills, and I wanted this particular deal, and he said, "Nope, I just gave it to such and such." And I hammered him a little bit, and he said, "Nope, it's lost. I've given it to such and such." And he looked at his watch, and he said, "It's 5 o'clock. I'm done talking business." And I said, "It's 5 o'clock. So am I." And he whipped out a bottle of bourbon whiskey, and he says, "I drink bourbon whiskey." And I said, "So do I." He said, "I drink it straight." "So do I." 3 hours later, I had the order. The biggest order I had ever written. Biggest order my company had ever written. But occasionally, that's my good drinking. I can tell stories like that because I can remember them. But what's the ones that I wake up in the morning when it's just dreadful? Wake up and look at the fifth that you opened last night and say, "Jesus, I didn't have to drink that much. I was drunk long before I drank it down to there." You know? What a waste of good bourbon whiskey, pouring it down the throat of a drunk, for God's sake. I had no fun. The fun went out. And I spent 28 years chasing the illusion that I was having fun. I was, after about 10 years, 11 years, my first wife decided that she could no longer exist in life. And I woke up off of a running drunk and to find out that she had committed suicide. And I went absolutely mad. Because at that time I had five little girls. I did not know where they lived. I did not know whether they were alive. I didn't know anything about it. It took an awful lot of people to put me in a straitjacket to haul me down into the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital. And while I was in there, the company that I was with sent word to me that I was fired because I projected the wrong image to this corporation. I got out of that place and collected my five little girls. I had to con my way out. You know, it's a frightening thing. I don't know how many people have ever been locked up. I remember, I don't know how many people have been in a straitjacket. I'm thinking of all of the grandiose, grand, and beautiful ideas that I had in life of what kind of a person I wanted to be. But I remember laying on this gurney, all strapped down, coming out of whatever, they had pumped an awful lot of crap in me. Because apparently I was quite violent. Because when you take as much bourbon whiskey as it was in me and then they start putting these medications and crap that they were putting in on top of me, I must have had a pretty violent reaction. I don't know. But I was laying there on this damn table, all covered with blood in a straitjacket, and they were debating whether they dared let me loose because I was too violent. And I will never forget, as long as I live, the doctor looking me in the face, because he saw that I was awake and had come to. And he looked at me and he said, "You won't hurt me, will you?" And you know, I couldn't answer him because I didn't know. I didn't know. I was in such absolute rage because I didn't know whether I was alive. I didn't know whether I was dead. I didn't know where my kids were. I didn't care. So I couldn't answer him, and that's a wonderful testimonial. I remember a little later on that same place, I was laying on another table I came to. This time they'd taken a straitjacket off, and I was strapped to the table. And they'd done a poor job. And I could see that I could get myself loose. And I was in there with a couple other nuts. I was in good company. So I got loose, and I looked at them, and they were looking at me, and they were terrified. They were absolutely terrified because they didn't know what I was going to do, and neither did I, and all I could do is sit there and cry. Great, big, strong dude, sit there and cry. Couldn't even get off the goddamn gurney. Wonderful life in the nut house. I got out of there to attend my wife's funeral, and they sent me back in. Then I got out and I gathered my girls and found out that I was boycotted and unemployable in Southern California. The industry is a relatively tight industry, and the companies were all in collusion and no one would hire me in Southern California, so I came to Northern California. And out of respect to my adopted daughter, Judy, I've got to tell a story about how I learned to become a father. I want you to know one of the proud things of my life. I look back on it. One of the proud things of my life. I got five girls. At that time, two of them were in diapers, and I used to brag that I had never changed a diaper. What a wonderful father. I learned how to change diapers. I learned how to wash them. I learned how to cook. I learned how to iron. That's it. Now, this happens to be so long ago that maybe you won't remember it. This is, most of you don't even know the time existed. It was a time before wash and wear. That all your clothes were ironed. And one of my oldest daughters had the most beautiful dress you would ever want to know. It was a peasant dress. The basic material was a dark brown. And it had peasant type with rows and rows of white lace ribbons all the way around, typical puff sleeves, a lace yoke, and lace. White. Beautiful thing. And I did all of my ironing when all the kids were asleep after I washed them and fed them and put them to bed, and I'd do the ironing, the washing and the ironing, me and a little bottle of Jack Daniels. I remember ironing that peasant dress and had a sip and looked down and said, oh, God, I had scorched the living daylights out of that white lace. Just dreadful thing. And always having a swift mind and clean thinking, I spent the next 2.5 hours and the rest of the Jack Daniels scorching all the rest of the lace to match. That's Judy's story. Well, it made sense to me. The little snot never wore the dress either. I was a chief engineer for the company in Northern California working in South San Francisco. They hired me and I became division manager. And while I was there, the company that had I had worked for that I was so successful with, who had fired me when I was in the nut house, signed a contract with my corporation so that we became a material supplier to them for all of their products of a specific type. And they had to buy them from me. And I knew every one of them. Every 11 Western states, every branch manager who used to be a salesman with me, and I knew every one of them. And I didn't like them. A lot. And they'd call me, and I would be brutal with them, and they'd say, John, when can I get such and such? And I would say something to, like, when I'm damn well ready to give it to you. And then one day, a young lady from the production control department called me. She had a pleasant voice. She was a girl. I didn't know her. And she asked real questions, and she seemed to know what the hell she was talking about. And I gave her a straight-up, honest answer. And I enjoyed it. A couple days later, she called me again, and we chatted, and I did the same thing. I enjoyed it, and I said to myself, well, hell, I do not have to talk to these other rotten bastards. So I put the word out to the 11 Western states that nobody was going to talk to me except the girl in production control. I thought it was fitting and fine. They objected to it, but they didn't have any choice because I refused to discuss anything with them. Now, don't you tell me revenge is not sweet. Even the owner of this damn company, the bastard who signed my checks, had to go running across the way into that little bridge to go see the girl in production control. A multi-million-dollar corporation had to go in there and see that little girl in production control. Would you call John and ask him? I got to know this chick pretty well. Never met her. Had some guys working for me that knew her. They told me about her. I was interested in her, and she was very, very talented, wonderful voice. I loved talking to her, and I told her my life as I understood my life, and she told me her life as she understood her life at the time. Told her I was not a Catholic just because I had 5 little girls. You know, my witticism at the time was the fact I'm an oversexed Protestant. Actually, what it was, I was a periodic drunk, is what it really was. She said that she was a divorcee and that she had a little boy and she had a little girl. And I decided to hire her because of her great talent, but in order to do that, I wanted to see her and meet her and find out if we were compatible. So I took her out on a date. I had my first and only blind date. And when I first looked at her, I said, oh, my God, she's bigger than I have ever, bigger girl than any girl I've ever been with. Then I looked and said, oh, my God, she wears falsies. And we went out and we just had a wonderful time. Just a wonderful time. So much so that a couple days later, I called her and wanted to come on over to have another date with her. And I did. And she molested me. Now, always one of great propriety, I decided that you couldn't have things like that going on in an office, so I decided to marry her. So 8 weeks later, we got married. And overnight, this poor woman reached the pinnacle of her success. She had always, this woman was born an Al-Anon. Waiting for an alcoholic to happen, and I gave her fulfillment. Overnight, at the age of 26, she's got 7 kids. And a drunk. And I don't know which is worse. And I remember I proposed to her in a supermarket between the peanut butter and the mayonnaise. And I said, honey, stick with me. I didn't even say that. I said, stick with me, baby. Cool, man. Stick with me, baby. I'll take you places you've never gone, and we'll do things you've never gone, and we'll see things you've never seen. I've been called a prophet before. For the next 15 and a half years, we went up and down the state of California like a wind. I made less and less money every year as the disease of alcoholism ran rampant through our life. 9 years before I got here, and we'd been married about 9 years before I got here, I was in a town called Fresno. And it was the worst time in my life because one more time I knew that I had failed it again. You see, I'd always known that if I did a little better, if I worked a little harder, if I could do something right instead of getting it all wrong, I could just handle this thing and get it right. I want to be a good father. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good citizen. I want to be a good lover. I want to be good. I want to be those things, and I could never do it. And I was 9 years before I got here, and I was sitting in Fresno, and I was a failure one more time. I bankrupt again. My kids didn't like me, and I knew it, and I didn't know why. My marriage, which had started out so awesomely, it deteriorated, and it was going on the rocks, and I couldn't do a goddamn thing about it. It seemed as if every time I turned around, I was screwing it up, and I didn't know why. I did not know why. There's a line in the book that I quote frequently because it best describes my condition at that particular time. This is the way I saw my life. It said to me, you have but one direction or alternative to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation as best you can. And that was 9 years before I got here. I was just merely trying to stay alive long enough to give my kids a fair start in life, because at that particular time is when we had a medical miracle. Our little son, Daniel, Peggy announced that she was pregnant. And it condemned me to live longer just to give a fair start. And when I walked into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous 9 years later, on an accident, I didn't come here for sobriety. And I quite honestly didn't stay here for sobriety at the beginning. I came here to find out what creeps do on Tuesday nights. That's what I said that particular night when they called on me. And I was insulted in that night so badly that I got the life that seemed to be offered to you. Somebody said in my first meeting, you will never have to drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. I don't know what you hear when I say that, but this is what I heard when they said that. Have to drink. The concept that I had to drink. never entered my mind. Now, I have been listening to people say in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, they drank because of this, because of that, because of this, and because of that. If you be alcoholic, it is my understanding you drink because you have to, because you cannot live without drinking. And I didn't know it then, but that's the thing that got to me, have to drink. I just started my mind thinking just a little bit. I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted the way of life. Now, there's a few things that you have to do in sobriety that I didn't know whether I could do or not. These 12 steps didn't bother me a whit. I'd been more than pleased to have done any one of those 12 steps at a drop of a hat. As a matter of fact, I frequently say the first night I came home from my meeting, I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, studied those 12 steps, and studied those 12 steps, took all the 12 steps, and then went to my second meeting. But that's what I thought I did. That's how much intellect I had. But in looking at those things, there's nothing I did was willing to do. Good God, have you all figured you were going to die? I'm sure you always have. Many of you have. I certainly have. Have you figured out your tombstone? Yes, I did. My tombstone, the epitaph was, "There lies John. He tried." I looked at step four and I said, "By God, at least there's somebody going to find out I tried." Because I have. I tried. I tried. But there were some problems in getting into this thing, you know. It says the first thing I had to look at is it says that, thank God, it says when you were talking in here, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Did you know that the preamble of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the only requirement for membership, or the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking? Now, I do not know what you hear when you see that, but I know that what I did is, first of all, I was here for the way of life, and sobriety wasn't of any interest to me at the time. I wasn't drinking because you didn't drink, and that was all right for me. So I took the fact that they had taken an honest desire and changed it into a desire to stop drinking, and then that allowed people like me to stay here. I had a dishonest desire to stop drinking. I didn't have to drink. I didn't have to have an honest desire to stop drinking. And I'm so grateful for that, because I came here and people would ask me. I didn't speak in AA meetings because they were wise enough not to ask me. But when I would talk with people before and after meetings, and they'd ask me, I couldn't give them a drunk log because I didn't have one. Because they didn't know what I know now. And I would lie to them. Because I wanted to belong. So I would lie to them. And so if you're embellishing your drunkologue today because you think you have to, it's all right. It's all right. Because whatever it takes to stay here, and I had to stay here with a dishonest desire to stop drinking. Now I'm so grateful that I fell in love with a man called Chuck Chamberlain. And I'm so grateful that I had a set of tapes to him. From him, which later became the book that many of you know as A New Pair of Glasses. I am so grateful that I met him. I'm so grateful that I fell in love with his tapes. I am so grateful for that. Because it altered my life. He started to teach me in words that I could understand perhaps a little bit differently than was spoken in AA meetings. Not that I am a big book thumper, because Chuck is a big book thumper. I believe in the program of recovery. I wholeheartedly endorse this way of life. But Chuck taught me things that I possibly couldn't have learned any other way. First of all, he told me that my life was broken and that my marriage was ruined and my kids didn't love me. And I worked for a crook, and I was a crook, And he told me there was not a thing that I could do about that. And so I better not try. He taught me this. He said, if you work the 12 steps for the purpose by which the steps are written, for sobriety, if you work the 12 steps for the purpose by which the steps are written, for sobriety, these related disorders will take care of themselves. Now, there are many people, and I like to talk about my wife a great deal. First of all, she deserves it. But secondly, because we have a relationship that is truly remarkable. And I always, when it comes up, I always have to tell you that I haven't done a thing to fix a broken relationship. I haven't done a thing. Because I wouldn't know how. Now, we have a fabulous deal going on between she and I. I was sober for a period of time until I realized that everything I was ever looking for in the woman I was already married to, the girl of my dreams, best friend, lover, companion, the only person in this world that I could spend the rest of my life with and look forward to it. I never have had enough time to be with her as much as I would like. I could go on and on with those things that I about my wife. And I didn't do anything to remedy a broken relationship. I didn't. People come to me quite a bit and ask me, well, how did you do it? I said, I didn't do it. I don't know how. But I will suggest strongly about that they see to it about cleaning their own house and doing their own stuff. And I'll tell them what I did. And when they try it, it seems to work for them. But not to fix a relationship. Not to fix a relationship. You see, mine was broken and that gave me the freedom. There's a song, I do not know the name of it, but it's got a line in it that says, freedom is just another word for having nothing else to lose. You see, when I got here, I knew that everything that was near and dear to me was gone from me, and it was my fault, because Chuck taught me that. It was my fault. I broke it. And I was not entitled to have it back. And the book also tells me that even if you were to get it back, it better be on a new basis because the old basis didn't work anyway. But I don't know anything about a new basis of life. So this is what I did, very simply. I started studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to figure out what to do. First thing I had to do is that it says I had become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you may be here, and you might be in this room, but you may not be a member. Now, to me, this is my story, and therefore, to me, to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to learn how to share. Because it says Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share. Now, if you've been here for any length of time, you damn well better start to learn how to share. And I'm not talking about this long crap out of the side of your neck. And I'm not talking about flexing your muscles. And I'm not talking about all that bullshit that works so well on the street corner, out in the sidewalk, or in the saloon. Just shine it on, baby. Looking cool at any cost. That's not sharing. That's that bullshit that I came from. I have what I know how to do. That's what killed me. That's what helped destroy my life. You know, the girl that was speaking, I had a flash. The girl that was speaking here on the 10-minute speaker said she's not used to these emotions and she's just, she wonders how normal people feel. And I just had a flash. God, do you know normal people probably feel that way all the time and don't think it's abnormal? And we have a chance to really feel it? God, isn't that exciting? It is to me. One of the things that I ran from all my life was my feelings. It's the greatest thing I have. The excitement of life. The joy of life. the feeling of love that I have, expression of the love I have, the fact that I can stand in front of this many people and say, I love most of you, and I absolutely adore my wife. You know? And there's no reward in that because I've already got my reward because I can love. God, I hope I never get used to that feeling. Normal people will probably, maybe are born with it. I don't know. Because I'm not normal, so I don't know. And I'll never find out. But I hope to God I never lose it. So this business of sharing, I had to go home and start sharing. I went home to share. Chuck didn't tell me it was tough to do that. Chuck told me he went home and shared. So I went home and shared. I had nothing to lose. Hell, you guys knew I would be trying to learn how to share, and you'd laugh at me. So I went home, told her, started sharing with her. She didn't know what was happening. She shared back. Chuck didn't tell me about that. She shared back. But thank God the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as good as it is, warned me that I had to avoid retaliation and fault finding should be avoided like the plague. And they became mandates in my life. They were then and are now. So I had to learn how to share. I had to start studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew if I was going to make this thing, I had to truly understand make the first step of recovery or concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I would have been given anything to have conceded to myself. It wasn't because I was trying to conceal it. It wasn't because I was unwilling to. I did not know. I wanted to be an alcoholic, for God's sake. I wanted this way of life, and step one requires me to understand the depth and meaning of my disease. And so I did exactly what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests. I studied it. The description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our adventures before and after make clear. Clear. Until I was 4 months sober, they were not clear. Then all hell broke loose one night, and oh, they got clear. They got clear. I remember screaming to the God of my understanding at that particular time, in the only fashion I could, I was learning how to pray. I was still learning how to pray, and I still am as far as I'm concerned. The best prayer I could get is the only one that's required. It was God. That's all I could say. What I meant to say is that if I live through this without killing anybody or drinking, I got enough information to go through the 12 steps of recovery. I lived through it. I didn't drink. I remember to the bravado and the bullshit and all the rest of that stuff. I remember I bought my wife a drink that night. A martini. And I'm going through all this goddamn agony because I don't know how yet to feel. I just want to destroy. And I'm holding that martini in my hand shaking. And I'm the damn thing's dripping on my hand. I don't remember the terror that I'm going to lick it off. And that's it. I'm going to lick it off. And I reach, just like I'm doing right now, reach there, like that. Wipe that hand off so I could set that damn martini glass in front of her. Because I didn't want to accidentally lick it off. Because you told me alcohol in any form, whether it be cough syrup, a lick off your finger, or a bottle of Jack Daniels, alcohol in any form, surrenders my right to be here, and I'm not willing to accept that. Even when I did not have the knowledge that I do have today. I was rocketed through the 12 steps of recovery, not through any virtue, not even through choice. It was by sheer God's grace or the impetus created by the desire that I do not. Then, nor now, I do not and will never live that way again. when I was a little boy. And I was so poor, so pure that little kids are. My mother used to say, what a good boy I was. What a good little boy I was. My mother was a wonderful woman. You know, and I talk about the hardships my family may have had, but I was a good little boy in a good little house full of love and compassion. And I remember this thing. Bill Wilson talks about dreams of vainglory. I remember that little boy saying, one day I'm going to grow up. And I'm going to be rich, and I'm going to be famous, and everything's going to be okay. I've always had that dream. Even when I was grinding it in the mud, I've always had that dream. Never lost the dream. It was covered up. I don't have to live that way anymore. I don't really have to live that more. And whatever your circumstances are in this room tonight, these 12 steps guarantee, this program of recovery guarantee, you don't ever have to live that way anymore. You don't want to. God changed the reality of your own being. You can certainly change your position in reality. And that's what happened. So I lived in hell for 48 years, and I had good times, I had bad times, but I've lived in heaven for the last 19 years. So I know what it's like to be on the other side. I know what it's like to be reborn. What a wonderful word that is. Reborn. Reborn into a world that was here all along and I couldn't see it. Reborn into a marriage that it was a travesty that has turned into a thing of beauty. Reborn into a father who was a louse and has turned into a pretty damn good human being and a father. Reborn as a human being. Reborn as a feeling human being. What a wonderful thing that is. I was catapulted, as I say, through the 12 steps of recovery. I took my third step. If you've noticed that I have a tendency for grandiosity, I took my third step with my wife, our 17-year-old daughter, my 8-year-old son, and the young man who brought me to my first AA meeting as a witness. Now, you don't have to do that if you don't want to. But you see, I was recognized the time I was taking my third step. It happened to be the second most important decision I was ever going to make in my life. Second most. First was to become willing to go to any lengths for recovery. Second most decision I've ever made is to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I, as Chuck taught me, he says, here are the steps we took. So, took them. And that means to me that when you have taken a step, there's no wassailing, there's no waddling. You have either taken a step or you haven't taken a step. And that's the end of it. And it's not subject to debate. I sometimes hear people who say, well, I think I took my third step. I've got too much at stake to think about this crap. I've got far too much. I've got to know what I've done. So we turned our will and our lights that night, or that afternoon, up in that little glen. Oh, what a beautiful day today was for the with the sunlight out, and that's the day that I took my third step. That Peggy took her third step. My daughter took her third step. And our 8-year-old son pulled on his mother's arm and said, Mommy, will you do it for me too? How could I forget that? Grandiosity, yeah. What a prized memory that is. My heart warms when I just think about that particular day. You don't have to do it that way. But I did. I sat down and wrote my fourth step. It was a powerful revelation for me. The information I was looking for was contained for me in the exact nature of my wrongs. The fifth column in the fourth step. The fifth one. And if you don't know what the fifth one is, find out what the fifth step is, fifth column is. And the exact nature of my wrong. And I remember slamming my hand down on that table. And the wee small hours in the morning and screaming out loud, "Never again! They are no longer have to control me. I do not have to live that way anymore. Truth is mine. I don't have to live that way anymore." So I got up and I went out and went to work and I ran over to my sponsor's office and said, "I'm doing my fifth step." And he said, "I'm busy." And I said, "I'm not." And I sat down and I waited. And every once in a while, Jack would look up and said, "I'm busy." And I would say, "I'm not." And he'd say, an hour would go by, 2 hours would go by. He said, "I'm still busy." And I said, "I'm not." And finally he said, "Oh, shit, let's go." So that dreaded fourth step, my secrets that I will die with, were delivered. My fifth step was delivered in a booth by the front door of the Sherwood Inn restaurant on Almaden Road. And the waitress and anybody walking past must have got an earful. And you know, I'm spilling my guts, and the people walking by and the waitress didn't give a damn. And I thought they'd been horrified. "Oh, my God, John Carney's doing a fifth step. Let's all go." They didn't care. What happened is I was told that I had done a good fifth step and to go home and do 6 and 7 just exactly the way it's written in the book. And I did. I did an eighth step. I did an eighth step and was entirely willing and ready and eager. I wanted this thing through. I'm ready. And it's a good thing I was, because God in His infinite wisdom jugged, pushed, stuck people in my face left and right. I went up and down the state of California because I had to wind up. Not because I'm doing ninth step work, is because I had to do there and the ninth step was in front of me. I tell this one, it's kind of graphic. I would have had to hang up the telephone, walk across the street, not answer my front door, and bury my head in the covers to avoid doing my ninth step. It was just that simple. And I was a roaring through and I was all done. And I said to Peg, "I'm finished with my ninth step." She said, "You got all the names?" I said, yep, got them all done." She said, "I got some names." Married to a good, faithful Al-Anon, she probably did. And she did. But this is just to give you an illustration of my ninth step. She said, "Well, what about David C?" And I said, "Oh, my God. David wasn't on my list. He should have been on my list. David happened to be a young man that I loaded a pistol once, and I was going to go blow that little bastard away. It wasn't on my list." Now, it's not because I was bad. He just wasn't on my list. I'm not a badass. I don't claim that. The best I can give you about my fifth step was mediocre. That's the best I can give you. You know, average. Average. Nobody wants to be average in step five. I want to be really bad. I want to be really good, but average. That's all I was. But I didn't have David on my list. Because the last time I didn't see him that day, but I remember talking to him on the telephone shortly after that, and I said, "Look, you little son of a bitch, you look over your shoulder for the rest of your life, because if you don't see me first, you're dead." That's the way we parted. And I hadn't seen David probably for 7 or 8 years, and it's good. And we were at the bowling alley when Peggy came up with his name, and we walked home, and the phone was ringing. And I picked up the telephone. It was my daughter who lived in Nebraska at that time, my oldest daughter. And we chatted for a bit, and she's wonderful. My daughter's talking to me, and everything's cool. And then I said, "By the way, honey, Do you have any idea whatever happened to David? She said, yes, Daddy, I do. Why, what would you like to, what you know, need to know? And I said, well, honey, I started explaining the program of recovery a little bit, and I talked about step 9. And she said, oh, Daddy, I'm so grateful. Just a minute, he's standing right beside me. And that's one of many stories I can tell you. Step 9. And then I moved into a 10-step. And I need to tell you, from the moment I started in this program, from my 4th month to this month, there has never been a night that I have not done a 10-step. There has never been a day, to my knowledge, that I have not made repeated spot check inventories. And by the grace of God, there never will be. I'm the guy that had to learn how to pray. I'm the one that's written in my book, when I became willing to become willing to become willing to pray, to learn how to pray, where prayer becomes a functional part of my life. It is the way I live. It's the way I think. I've had my ups and downs in sobriety, but I have, because of the faith and trust in a God of my very own, that is, you have given me a God of my very own. You have allowed me to choose my relationship with God. You have allowed me to build it on base rock. Make sure that I have built an edifice, that I am proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am proud to have a God of my very own. I have developed, it is not, it is far more important. You know, they talk about believing in God, which is important, but this is a relationship with God. A relationship with God. As you see me, you see my God. I'm the only one of His kids there is around. Now, you are the child of your God, but I am the child of the God of my understanding. And the things I do, the way I act, and as I behave myself, is a direct and immediate reflection of the God of my understanding. And I do not wish to let him down. Chuck gave me one of the greatest prayers that I could possibly have ever used. And it was the toughest one I've ever had to say, because I had to gag on it. This is back when I'm still just trying to learn how to pray. He said, Father, I want to go out and act like your kid. What a load when you don't know what a child of God acts like. You damn well are going to change the way you talk, the way you think, the way you act. So I started this meeting and basically in telling you this is the only good life. And that's true. When I consider the countless mornings that I have awakened to look at the wreckage of whatever the hell I did or didn't do or knew that I did or didn't know, or the vague horrors of yesterday, and saying, I've got more time. How many countless hours that I had to drink the demons away so that I could put my head on that pillow with some hope of going to sleep? How many times have I laid in my bed with a wife that was crying, knowing it was my fault, and knowing there was not a thing I could do to stop it, because I don't even know what the hell I did. Whatever your circumstances are in life, you never have to live that way again. The magic was told to me when I got here, that you will never have to drink again as long as you live if you do not want to. And that is the gospel truth, without any question whatsoever. Because since I'm waving my arms and screaming and jumping up and down and doing things like that, there is a little line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous where a person like me, who was unfit to live on this earth, who believed that the good ones died and rotten bastards like me had to live, considered himself a murderer when he got here, had never been able to do anything right, was condemned to hurt the people that he loved most of all, constitutionally incapable of living without hurting people. You have allowed me, and you all belong in this same field if you wish to be. If you are not already there, the book says that we can all become intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. Thank you.